Can we reduce C. diff infections among people in the hospital?
Using behavioral science to modify antibiotic use.
How about beneath the tongue immunotherapy for people with asthma?
And are smoking cessation drugs safe in mentally ill patients?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on April 29th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine, and recording from Boston, Massachusetts.
Very good. I think we should start, Rick, with The Lancet. This issue of, hey, what about these meds that are used to help people quit smoking? Are they potentially problematic with regard to mental illness?
This is a trial that was specifically requested by the US FDA, and they also consulted on the study design because there's some concern that some of the medications that are used for smoking cessation, varenicline and bupropion, may actually exacerbate depressive symptoms or suicide ideation in people that have mental illness. So there's actually a black box warning that physicians would see when they prescribe these medications. Is that really an issue? So this was a very large study, over 8,100 participants, about half of whom had some mental illness, for example, a mood disorder or anxiety. The other half did not have mental illness, and they were randomized to one of four different treatments. They could have gotten bupropion or varenicline, the ones we were concerned about. They could have gotten nicotine replacement, or they could have gotten placebo. So in general, let me summarize by saying none of the medications increased or exacerbated the risk of neuropsychiatric adverse problems. Now, there were some individuals, those that didn't have psychiatric issues, and those that did, a small number, 2.5 to 6% for both groups, that did have some moderate to severe neuropsychiatric issues, but they weren't related to the medications. It was just indigenous to the particular patient population. That tells us that, in fact, these medications can be given to individuals with psychiatric illness. But nevertheless, we still need to monitor all individuals. In this group, all the medications were more effective than nothing in causing smoking abstinence. However, varenicline seemed to be a little bit better than the other two, but the other two were still better than placebo.
When you say better, what was the number? Because those have been pretty sad, of course, in the past.
For those who received placebo, about 10 to 15%. For those who received varenicline, about a third of them stopped. And for those who received either nicotine replacement or bupropion, about a fourth stopped smoking.
And I would suggest that relative to follow-up for this study, it would be how about combinations of medications and then also combination with things like CBT?
Yep, great questions. We know that CBT is effective, and previous studies in different patient populations have shown its combination is more effective than either alone. However, this particular study didn't address it.
But of course, I'm going to go back to, hey, let's just outlaw those cigarettes to begin with. We won't have to worry about this.
In Texas, we like outlaw.
From here, why don't we turn to an issue that we talked about a while ago? This was this idea of sublingual immunotherapy. Gosh, can we take these little substances, stick them under someone's tongue, and induce a tolerance to something to which they're allergic? In this case, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, it was looking at that relative to dust mites in people who have asthma.
I didn't realize how big an issue that dust mite allergies were, but apparently for people that have asthma, house dust mite sensitization is present in about 50% of them, and it contributes to the exacerbations. We know that overall, the sublingual immunotherapy, what's called SLIT, is a little bit less effective than the way it's typically given. That is by injection, SCIT, subcutaneous immunotherapy. But the advantages of the sublingual versus the injectable form has been all year round. The sublingual, you can just prescribe before the allergy season and for a little bit afterwards. There are obviously a lot of people that don't want to have injections, and they prefer the sublingual as well. But what this study tried to address was, is sublingual immunotherapy effective in people that have moderate to severe asthma that's not very well controlled on corticosteroids, and we're trying to decrease the steroids or stop them altogether, can the sublingual immunotherapy help prevent asthma exacerbations? It looked at over 800 people that were randomized to either receive placebo or one of two different doses of the sublingual immunotherapy. And they asked over the 6 months of follow-up whether there was a decrease in asthma exacerbations. And what they found is that both doses of immunotherapy were better than placebo. It reduced it by about 30% compared to placebo. This translates to an absolute reduction of about 8%.
We know, of course, that those asthma exacerbations in people who have moderate or more severe disease result in hospitalizations. So that's, of course, something that's very desirable to avoid. The other thing I think is interesting about this study is, to me, it suggests this whole strategy of sublingual immunotherapy, I think, might get expanded into more populations.
And that's a possibility. There's a limited approval from the FDA right now. This was a single allergen, house dust mite. It's not approved in the U.S., although it is in Europe. Several questions in my mind. Those with less severe symptoms, would it be effective? Secondly, would it be more effective if we had multiple allergens in it as well? As you suggest, Elizabeth, I think it's becoming more widely accepted because it is effective.
And that's good news for allergy sufferers. And as someone who has a dust mite allergy, I'm looking forward to that little pill under my tongue at some point. So let's turn now back to The Lancet, a study that you picked regarding what's called antibiotic stewardship.
And this is a big issue. We know that there's a large amount of antibiotic overusage. Individuals that don't have a proven bacterial infection or may have a viral infection, and they come into the doctor and either they demand antibiotics or the doctor feels like they have to give the patient antibiotics. It's not effective in curing the underlying condition, but it does expose the patient to the risk of antibiotics, and more importantly, to causing antibiotic-resistant organisms. So there is a worldwide effort to reduce antibiotic usage. In this particular study, they try to use behavioral sciences, something called social norm feedback. They identify the individuals, the physicians, that are over-prescribing, and they tell them, you're outside the norm. Question is that enough to change their behavior? In the United Kingdom, they have good records of what antibiotic usage is per physician. Most of the antibiotic overusage and variation occurs in the outpatient setting. So they identified the general practice physicians that were in the top 20% of overprescribers. And they tried one of two things. One is they sent them a note from the chief medical officer and I said, listen, you're in the top 20%. They gave them patient leaflets and they followed to see how that affected their antibiotic prescription practices. And they decreased by about 3.5%. What that amounts to is about 73,000 fewer antibiotic items dispensed during that time period. That particular intervention cost about $4,300. It saved about $280,000. The next thing they tried was informing the patients. They sent general information to the practice manager and had them give it to the patients, and that really didn't affect anything.
We have a lot of powerful tools at our disposal. We have electronic health records, we have insurance reimbursements and so forth that are going to allow us to discern, hey, who's doing this? And there's a lot more scrutiny possible. I'm wondering how especially community-based physicians and community-based primary care docs are going to respond to those kinds of interventions directed at them.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing about this wasn't a top-down approach. There was nobody mandating you had to change. But you're right, this is a complex issue.
I suspect we're going to be seeing more about this particular strategy. Finally, then, let's turn to another intervention that looks like it's helpful. I thought was really interesting in JAMA Internal Medicine. Hey, what about reducing Clostridium difficile, so-called C. diff infections? A big cause of both increasing sickness among people who are hospitalized as well as death. Is there a way that we can figure that out so that people don't acquire this infection when they're hospitalized?
In fact, this is now the leading cause of healthcare-associated infection in the United States. It leads to 29,000 deaths annually. This particular hospital where the study was done was a hospital in Quebec that had among some of the highest hospital-acquired C. diff infection rates in the country. They took a different approach. Let's identify people that are asymptomatic carriers that get admitted to the hospital and then put them on standard isolation. And here's what they discovered. You didn't have to wear gowns, but they used proper hand washing and gloves. A simple intervention of identifying, and by the way, 5% of the patients who presented to the emergency room had asymptomatic C. diff. They cut their hospital-acquired C. diff infection rate by more than 50%. How expensive was this? It cost them about $130,000 to do this, but it estimated to save them somewhere between $216,000 and $627,000. So in fact, it was a cost-effective measure.
Certainly, at least to me, suggests that there ought to be screening for people for C. diff and maybe even for a bunch of other hospital-acquired infections.
I would certainly say that this makes sense in hospitals that have a high rate of hospital-disseminated C. diff. So I think first you start with those hospitals, because I think you make a good case for it. And then your point's well taken. That is, do we need to screen for other diseases, particularly those that cause major problems? In this particular case, because it's so prevalent and it's so costly, both in terms of time and lives, it is a good strategy to screen for asymptomatic carriers.
I'm wondering how long it'll be before healthcare workers at large are screened for a multitude of these infections that people acquire in the hospital?
Yeah, great question. I don't have an answer to it. One of the things that makes C. diff particularly interesting to screen for is the spores stick around for a long period of time. And by the way, routine hand washing with alcohol-based detergents doesn't get rid of it. So that's why preventing its access to the hospital, even in asymptomatic carriers, is important.
On that note, I'm going to talk about the sublingual immunotherapy this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.